was still illegal then, wasn't it? There would have been references to secrecy or something.
But there are references to secrecy.
It's just an affair, he says, obviously.
What's this? The voice of experience?
Ha, not me.
He hands the letter back to her and drinks some of his tea. He has long squared-off fingers, working hands. Not a librarian's, she thinks absently. But what would a librarian's hands look like anyway? So you've never been involved with anyone married? She glances at his finger. Or you are married and have never had an affair?
Nope. And nope. Never had any kind of affair. With someone involved, that is. I like my life simple.
He nods at the letter, which she's tucking back into her bag.
Those things never end well.
What? All love that isn't simple and straightforward has to end tragically? She hears defensiveness in her voice.
That's not what I said.
Yes, it is. You said earlier that you thought she said no. He finishes his tea, crumples his cup and throws it into the bin bag.
We'll be done in 10 minutes. You better grab what you want. Show me what you haven't had a chance to go through and I'll try to keep it to one side.
As she gathers up her belongings, he says,
For what it's worth, I do think she probably said no.
His expression is unfathomable.
But why does that have to be the worst outcome?
I love you anyway, even if there isn't any me, or any love, or even any life. I love you. Zelda to Scott Fitzgerald, via letter. Chapter 17. Ellie Howarth is living the dream. She often tells herself so when she wakes up, hungover from too much white wine, feeling the ache of melancholy in her perfect little flat that nobody ever messes up in her absence. She secretly wants a cat, but is afraid of becoming a cliché. She holds down a job as a feature writer on a national newspaper, has obedient hair, a body that is basically plump and slender in the right places, and is pretty enough to attract attention that she still pretends offends her. She has a sharp tongue, too sharp according to her mother, a ready wit, several credit cards, and a small car she can manage without male help. When she meets people she knew at school, she can detect envy when she describes her life. She has not yet reached an age where the lack of a husband or children could be regarded as failure. When she meets men, she can see them ticking off her attributes. Great job, nice rack, sense of fun, as if she's a prize to be won. If recently she's become aware that the dream is a little fuzzy, that the edge she was once famed for at the office has deserted her since John came, that the relationship she had once found invigorating has begun to consume her in ways that are not exactly enviable, she chooses not to look too hard. After all, it's easy when you're surrounded by people like you, journalists and writers who drink hard, party hard, have sloppy, disastrous affairs, and unhappy partners at home who, tired of their neglect, will eventually have affairs. She is one of them, one of their cohorts, living the life of the glossy magazine pages, a life she had pursued since she had first known she wanted to write. She is successful, single, selfish. Ellie Howarth is as happy as she can be, as anyone can be, considering. And nobody gets everything, so Ellie tells herself, when occasionally she wakes up trying to remember whose dream she's meant to be living. Happy birthday, you old tart! Corinne and Nikki are waiting in the coffee shop, waving and patting a seat as she rushes in, bag flying. Come on, come on, you're so late! We're meant to be at work by now. Sorry, I got a bit held up coming out. They glance at each other, and she can tell they suspect she's been with John. She decides not to tell them that she was actually waiting for the post. She'd wanted to see if he had sent her something. Now, she feels foolish for making herself 20 minutes late for her friends. How does it feel to be ancient? Nikki has cut her hair. It's still blonde, but now short and choppy. She looks cherubic. I got your skinny latte. I'm assuming you're going to need to watch your weight from now on. 32's hardly ancient. At least that's what I'm telling myself. I'm dreading it, says Corinne. Somehow, 31 sounds like you might only just be past 30, still almost technically in your 20s. 32 sounds ominously close to 35. And 35 is obviously just a short step to 40. Nikki checks her hair in the mirror behind the banquette. And a happy birthday to you too, Ellie says. Oh, we'll still love you when you're wrinkly and alone and in flesh-coloured big knickers. They place two bags on the table. Here are your presents, and no, you can't exchange either of them. They've chosen perfectly, as only friends of many years' standing can. Corinne has bought her cashmere socks in dove grey, so soft that it's all Ellie can do not to put them on there and then. Nikki has given her a voucher for a prohibitively expensive beauty salon. It's for an anti-aging facial, she says wickedly. It was that or Botox. And we know how you feel about injections. She's filled with love, with gratitude for her friends. There have been many evenings in which they've said they're each other's new family. Their fear that the others will find mates first and leave them single and alone. Nikki has a new man, who, unusually, seems promising. He's solvent, kind, and has her on her toes just enough to keep her interested. Nikki has spent 10 years running away from men who behave well towards her. Corinne has just ended a relationship of a year. It was nice, she says, but they'd become like brother and sister. And I'd expected marriage and a couple of kids before that happened. They don't talk seriously of the dread that they may have missed the boat their aunts and mothers are so fond of mentioning. They don't mention that most of their male friends are now in relationships with women a good 5 to 10 years younger than themselves. They make jokes about growing old disgracefully. They line up gay friends who promise to have children with them in 10 years' time, if they're both single, while neither party believes that could possibly be so. What did he get you? Who? Ellie says innocently. Mr. Paperback Writer. Or was what he gave you the reason you were late? She already got her injection. Corinne cackles. You're both disgusting. She sips her coffee, which is lukewarm. I haven't seen him yet. But he is taking you out, Nikki says. I think so, she replies. She's suddenly furious with them for looking at her like that, for seeing through it already. She's furious with herself for not having thought up an excuse for him. She's furious with him for needing one. Have you heard from him at all, Elle? No, but it is only 8:30. Oh, Christ, I meant to be at a features meeting at 10 and I haven't got a single good idea. Well, sod him. Nikki leans over and hugs her. We'll buy you a little birthday cake, won't we, Corinne? Stay there and I'll get one of those muffins with icing. We'll have an early birthday tea. It's then that she hears the muffled tone of her mobile phone. She flips it open. Happy birthday, gorgeous. Present to come later. Kiss.
Him?
Says Corinne.
Yes, she grins. My present's coming later.
Like him. Nikki snorts back at the table with the iced muffin. Where's he taking you?
It doesn't say.
Show me. Nikki snatches it.
What the hell's that supposed to mean?
Nikki. Corinne's voice holds a warning note.
Well, present to come later. Kiss. It's a bit bloody vague, isn't it?
It's her birthday.
Exactly. And that's why she shouldn't have to decipher crappy halfway house messages from some half-baked boyfriend. Ellie, darling, what are you doing?
Ellie is frozen. Nikki has broken the unspoken rule that they will say nothing. No matter how foolish your relationship, they will be supportive. They will express concern through what is not said. They will not say things like, what are you doing?
It's fine, she says.
Really? Nikki looks at her. You're 32 years old. You've been in a relationship in love with this man for almost a year. And what you really deserve for your birthday isn't some measly text message that may or may not mean you get a seeing to at some unspecified date in the future.
Aren't mistresses at least meant to get expensive lingerie? The odd weekend in Paris?
Corinne is wincing.
I'm sorry, Corinne. I'm just telling it like it is for a change. Ellie, darling, I love you to death, but really, what are you getting out of this?
Ellie looks down at her coffee. The pleasure of her birthday is ebbing away.
I love him,
she says simply.
And does he love you?
She feels sudden hatred for Nicky.
Does he know you love him? Can you actually tell him so?
She looks up.
I rest my case,
says Nicky. The cafe falls silent around them. Or perhaps that's just how it feels. Ellie shifts in her chair. Corinne is still glaring at Nicky, who shrugs and lifts the muffin aloft.
Still. Happy birthday, eh? Anyone want another coffee?
She slides into her desk in front of her computer. There is nothing on her desk. No notes alerting her to flowers in reception. No chocolates or champagne. There are 18 emails in her inbox, not including the junk. Her mother, who bought a computer the previous year and still punctuates every emailed sentence with an exclamation mark, has sent her a message to wish her happy birthday, exclamation mark, and to tell her that the dog is doing well after having had his hip replaced, exclamation mark, and that the operation cost more than Grandma Howard's, 3 exclamation marks. The features editor's secretary has sent her a reminder about this morning's meeting, and Rory, the librarian, has sent her a message telling her to pop down later, but not before 4 p.m, as they'll be at the new building till then. There's nothing from John. Not even a thinly disguised greeting. She deflates a little, and winces when she sees Melissa striding towards her office, followed closely by Rupert. She is in trouble, she realizes, rifling through her desk. She has allowed herself to become so caught up in the letter that she has almost nothing to present from the 1960 edition. None of the contrasting examples that Melissa had asked for. She curses herself for having spent so long in the coffee shop, smooths her hair, grabs the nearest folder of papers, so that at least she looks as if she's on top of things, and runs into the meeting. So, the health pages are pretty much done and dusted, are they? And do we have the arthritis feature? I wanted that sidebar with the alternative remedies. Any celebrity arthritics? It'd liven up the pictures. These are a bit dull. Ellie is fiddling with her papers. It's almost 11. What would it have cost him to send some flowers? He could have paid cash at the florist's if he was really afraid of something showing up on his credit card. He'd done it before. Perhaps he's cooling. Perhaps the Barbados trip is his way of trying to reconnect with his wife. Perhaps telling her about it was his cowardly way of communicating that she's of less importance than she had been. She flicks through the saved text messages on her phone, trying to see if there's been a noticeable cooling off in his communications. Nice piece on the war veterans. Kiss. Free for lunch. I'm your way around 12:30. Jay. You are something else. Can't talk tonight. We'll message you first thing. Kiss. It's almost impossible to tell if there's any change in tone. There's so little to go on. Ellie sighs, flattened by the direction of her thoughts, by her friend's too blunt comments. What the hell is she doing? She asks for so little. Why? Because she's afraid that if she asks for more, he'll feel backed into a corner and the whole thing will crash down around them. She's always known what the deal was. She can't claim to have been misled. But just how little could she reasonably be expected to take? It's one thing when you know you're loved passionately and only circumstances are keeping you apart. But when there's no sign of that to keep the whole thing afloat. Ellie?
Hmm?
She glances up to find 10 pairs of eyes on her. You are going to talk us through the ideas for next Monday's edition. Melissa's gaze is both blank and all-seeing. The then and now pages.
Yes,
she says, and flips through the folder on her lap to hide her flush.
Yes. Well, I thought it might be fun to lift the old pages directly. There was an agony aunt, so I thought we could compare and contrast then with now.
Yes, says Melissa. That's what I asked you to do last week. You were going to show me what you'd found.
Oh, sorry. The pages are still in the archive. The librarians are a bit paranoid about making sure they know where everything is. What with the move? She stutters.
Why didn't you take photocopies?
Ellie, you're cutting this a bit fine. I thought she'd have a handle on it days ago.
Melissa's voice is icy. The others in the room look down, not wanting to witness the inevitable decapitation.
Would you like me to give the task to someone else? One of the work experience girls, perhaps?
She can see, Ellie thinks, that for months this job has just been a shadow on the radar of my day. She knows my mind's elsewhere, in a rumpled hotel bed, or an unseen family house, conducting a constant parallel conversation with a man who isn't there. Nothing exists but him, and she has seen right through me.
Melissa's eyes are on the ceiling.
Ellie realizes with sudden clarity the precariousness of her position.
I have something better, she says suddenly. I thought she'd like this more.
The envelope is nestling among the papers and she thrusts it at her boss.
I was trying to get a few leads on it.
Melissa reads the short letter and frowns.
Do we know who this is?
Not yet, but I'm working on it. I thought it'd be a great feature if I could find out what happened to them. Whether they ended up together.
Melissa was nodding.
Yes. It sounds extramarital. Scandal in the 60s, eh?
We could use it as a peg for how morality has changed. How close are you to finding them?
I've got feelers out.
Find out what happened, whether they were ostracized. If they stayed married, it's possible they won't want the publicity, Rupert observes. Such things were a much bigger deal back then.
Offer them anonymity if you have to, Melissa says. But ideally we'd like pictures, from the period of the letter, at least. That should make it harder for them to be identified. I haven't found them yet.
The tightening of her skin tells Ellie this was a bad idea.
But you will. Get one of the news journals to help if you need to. They're good at investigative stuff. And yes, I'd like that for next week. But first get those problem pages sorted out. I want examples I can lay out on a double-page spread by the end of the day, okay?
We'll meet again tomorrow, same time.
She's already striding towards the door, her perfectly groomed hair bouncing like a shampoo advert.
It's Mrs. Spelling Bee.
She finds him sitting in the canteen. He unplugs his earphones as she sits opposite. He's reading a guidebook to South America. An empty plate tells of lunch already eaten.
Rory, I'm in such trouble.
Spelt anti-disestablishmentarianism with four T's.
I let my mouth run away with me in front of Melissa Buckingham, and now I have to flesh out the love story to end all love stories for the features pages.
You told her about the letter.
I got caught out. I needed to give her something. The way she was looking at me, I thought I was about to be transferred to obits.
Well, that's going to be interesting.
I know. And before that, I've got to go through every problem page in the 1960 editions and find their moral equivalent in the modern day.
That's straightforward, isn't it?
But it's time-consuming, and I've got loads of other things I'm meant to be doing. Even without finding out what happened to our mystery lovers.
She smiled, hopefully.
I don't suppose there's anything you could do to help me.
Sorry. Stacked up myself. I'll dig out the 1960 newspaper files for you when I go back downstairs.
That's your job,
she protests. He grins.
Yup, and writing and researching is yours.
It's my birthday.
Then happy birthday.
Oh, you're all heart.
And you're too used to getting your own way.
He smiles at her, and she watches him gather up his book and MP3 player. He salutes as he heads towards the door.
You have no idea, she thinks, as it swings shut behind him. Just how wrong you are.
I'm 25, and I have quite a good job, but not a good enough job to do all the things I would like to do. To have a house and a car and a wife.
Because obviously you acquire one of those along with a house and a car,
Ellie mutters at the faded newsprint. Or perhaps after a washing machine. Maybe that should take priority.
I have noticed that many of my friends have got married, and their standard of living has dropped considerably. I've been going fairly regularly with a girl for 3 years, and I would very much like to marry her. I have asked her to wait 3 years until we can get married and live in rather better circumstances, but she says she is not going to wait for me.
3 years? Ellie muses. I don't blame her. You're hardly giving her the impression that yours is a great passion, are you?
Either we get married this year, or she won't marry me at all. I think this is an unreasonable attitude, since I have pointed out to her that she will have a rather lower standard of living. Do you think that there is any other argument that I can add to the ones I have made already?
No, pal, she says aloud, as she slides another old sheet of newspaper under the lid of the photocopier. I think you've made yourself quite clear. She returns to her desk, sits down, and pulls the crumpled, handwritten letter from her folder.
My dearest and only love, if you don't come, I'll know that whatever we might feel for each other, it isn't quite enough. I won't blame you, my darling. I know the past weeks have put an intolerable strain on you, and I feel the weight of that keenly. I hate the thought that I could cause you any unhappiness.
She rereads the words again and again. They hold passion, force, even after so many years. Why would you suffer the priggish,
I have pointed out to her that she will have a rather lower standard of living,
when you could have, know that you hold my heart, my hopes in your hands. She wishes the unknown girlfriend of the first correspondent a lucky escape. Ellie makes a desultory check for new email and mobile phone messages. She is 32 years old. She loves someone who is married to someone else. Her friends have begun to suggest that this, she, is ridiculous, and she hates them because she knows they are right. She chews the end of a pencil. She picks up the photocopied problem page and puts it down again. Then she clicks open a new message on her computer screen, and before she can think too hard about it, she types, "The one present I really want for my birthday is to know what I mean to you. I need for us to have an honest conversation, and for me to be able to say what I feel. I need to know whether we have any kind of future together." She adds, "I love you, John. I love you more than I have ever loved anyone in my whole life, and this is starting to drive me crazy." Her eyes are filled with tears. Her hand moves to send. The department shrinks around her. She is dimly aware of Caroline, the health editor, chatting on the phone at the next desk, of the window cleaner on his teetering cradle outside the window, of the news editor having an argument with one of his reporters somewhere on the other side of the office, the missing carpet tile at her feet. She sees nothing but the winking cursor, her words, her future, laid bare on the screen in front of her. "I love you more than I have ever loved anyone my whole life." If I do this now, she thinks, it will be decided for me. It will be my way of taking control. And if it isn't the answer I want, at least it's an answer. Her forefinger rests gently on send. And I will never touch that face, kiss those lips, feel those hands on me again. I will never hear the way he says, "Ellie Howarth," as if the words themselves are precious. The phone on her desk rings. She jumps, glances at it, as if she's forgotten where she is, then wipes her eyes with a hand. She straightens, then picks it up. "Hello?"
"Hey, birthday girl," says Rory. "Get yourself down to the cells at chucking out time. I might just have something for you. And bring me a coffee while you're at it. That's the charge for my labours."
She puts down the receiver, turns back to her computer and presses delete. "So, what did you find?" She hands a cup of coffee over the counter, and he takes it. There's a fine sprinkling of dust in his hair, and she fights the urge to ruffle it off as one would with a child. He has already felt patronized by her once. She doesn't want to risk offending him a second time.
"Any sugar?"
"No," she says. "I didn't think you took it."
"I don't."
He leans forward over the countertop.
"Look, boss is lurking. I need to be discreet. What time are you finishing?"
"Whenever," she says. "I'm pretty much through." He rubs his hair. The dust forms an apologetic cloud around him.
I feel like that character in Peanuts. Which was it?
She shook her head.
Pigpen. The one with the dirt floating around him. We're shifting boxes that haven't been touched in decades. I can't really believe we're ever going to need parliamentary minutes from 1932, whatever it says. Still, the Black Horse? Half an hour?
The pub?
Yes.
I thought it might have plans.
She wants to ask, can't you just give me what you found? But even she can see how ungrateful that will sound. It'll only take 10 minutes. I've got to meet some friends afterwards anyway. But it's cool. It can wait till tomorrow if you'd prefer.
She thinks about her mobile phone, mute and recriminating in her back pocket. What's her alternative? Rushing home and waiting for John to call there. Another evening spent sitting in front of the television, knowing that the world is revolving somewhere without her. Oh, what the hell. A quick drink would be great.
Half a shandy. Live dangerously.
Shandy? Huh. I'll see you in there.
He grins. I'll be the one clutching a file marked Top Secret.
Oh, yes. I'll be the one shouting, buy me a proper drink, Chibo, it's my birthday.
No red carnation in your buttonhole, just so I can identify you.
No means of identification. That way, it's easier for me to escape if I don't like the look of you.
He nods approvingly. Sensible.
And you're not even going to give me a clue as to what you found?
Some birthday surprise that'd be.
With that, he's gone. Back through the double doors and into the bowels of the newspaper. The ladies is empty. She washes her hands, noting that now the building's days are numbered, the company is no longer bothering to refresh the soap dispenser or the tampon machine. Next week, she suspects, they'll have to start bringing in emergency loo roll. She checks her face, applies some mascara and paints out the bags under her eyes. She puts on lipstick, then rubs it off. She looks tired and tells herself the lighting in there is harsh, that this is not an inevitable consequence of being a year older. Then she sits beside a washbasin, pulls her phone from her bag and types a message. Just checking. Does later mean this evening? I'm trying to work out my plans. E. It doesn't come across as clingy, possessive, or even desperate. It suggests that she's a woman with many offers, things to do, but implies that she'll put him first if necessary. She fiddles with it for a further 5 minutes, making sure she has the tone completely right, then sends it. The reply comes back almost immediately. Her heart jumps, as it always does when she knows it's him.
Difficult to say at the moment. We'll call later if I think I can make it. J.
A sudden rage ignites within her. That's it? She wants to yell at him. My birthday, and the best you can do is, we'll call later if I think I can make it. Don't bother, she types back, her fingers jabbing at the little keys. I'll make my own plans. And for the first time in months, Ellie Howarth turns off her phone before she sticks it into her bag. She spends longer than she intended working on the problem pages feature, writes up an interview with a woman whose child suffers from a form of juvenile arthritis. And when she arrives at the Black Horse, Rory is there. She can see him across the room, his hair now free of dust. She makes her way through the crowd towards him, apologizing for the bumped elbows, the badly negotiated spaces, already preparing to say, sorry I'm late, when she realizes he's not alone. The group of people with him are not familiar. They're not from the newspaper. He's at their center, laughing. Seeing him like this, out of context, throws her. She turns away to gather her thoughts.
Hey, Ellie!
She paints on a smile and turns back. He lifts a hand.
Thought you weren't coming.
Got held up, sorry. She joins the group and says hello.
Let me buy you a drink. It's Ellie's birthday. What would you like?
She accepts the flurry of greetings from the people she doesn't know, letting them falter to a few embarrassed smiles and wishing she wasn't there. Making small talk wasn't part of the deal. She wonders, briefly, if she can leave, but Rory's already at the bar buying her a drink.
White wine? He says, turning to hand her a glass. I would have got champagne, but...
I get my own way far too much already.
He laughs. Yeah, touché.
Thanks anyway. He introduces her to his friends, reels off names she's forgotten even before he's finished. So?
She says, down to business. Excuse us for a minute, he says. And they make their way to a corner where it's emptier and quieter. There is only one seat, and he motions her to it, squatting on his haunches beside her. He unzips his rucksack and pulls out a folder marked Asbestos Case Studies. Symptoms.
And this is relevant because?
Patience, he says, handing it over. I was thinking about the letter we found last time. It was with a load of papers on asbestos, right? Well, there's heaps of stuff on asbestos downstairs from the group legal actions of the last few years, mainly. But I decided to dig around a bit further back and found some much older stuff. It's dated from much the same period as the bits I gave you last time. I think it must have become separated from that first file.
He flicks through the papers with expert fingers.
And, he says, pulling at a clear plastic folder, I found these.
Her heart stills. Two envelopes, the same handwriting, the same address, a P.O. box at Langley Street Post Office. Have you read them?
He grins. How much restraint do I look like I have? Of course I read them.
Can I?
Go ahead.
The first is simply headed Wednesday.
I understand your fear that you will be misunderstood, but I tell you it is unfounded. Yes, I was a fool that night in Alberto's, and I'll never be able to think of my outburst without shame. But it was not your words that prompted it. It was the absence of them. Can't you see, Jenny, that I'm predisposed to see the best in what you say? What you do? But just as nature abhors a vacuum, so does the human heart. Foolish, insecure man that I am, as we both seem so unsure what this actually comprises, and we cannot talk about where it may go, all that is left to me is reassurance about what it may mean. I simply need to hear that this is for you what it is for me. In short, everything. If those words still fill you with trepidation, I give you an easier option. Answer me simply in one word. Yes.
On the second, there is a date, but no greeting. The handwriting, while recognizable, is scrawled, as if it has been dashed off before its author could give it careful thought.
I swore I wouldn't contact you again. But 6 weeks on, and I feel no better. Being without you offers no relief at all. The fact that I'm no longer tormented by your presence, or presented with daily evidence of my inability to have the one thing I truly desire, has not healed me. It has made things worse. My future feels like a bleak, empty road. I don't know what I'm trying to say, darling Jenny. Just that if you have any sense at all that you made the wrong decision, this door is still wide open. And if you feel that your decision was the right one, know this at least, that somewhere in this world is a man who loves you, who understands how precious and clever and kind you are, a man who has always loved you, and, to his detriment, suspects he always will. Your B. Jenny, he says.
She doesn't reply.
She didn't go.
He says, yep, you were right.
He opens his mouth as if to speak, but perhaps something in her expression changes his mind.
She lets out a breath. I don't know why, she says, but that's made me feel a bit sad.
But you have your answer, and you have a clue to the name, if you really want to write this feature.
Jenny, she muses, it's not a lot to go on.
But it's the second letter that was found in files about asbestos, so perhaps she had some link to it. It might be worth going through the two files, just to see if there's anything else.
You're right. She takes the file from him, carefully replaces the letter in the plastic folder, and puts it all in her bag. Thanks, she says. Really, I know you're busy at the moment, and I appreciate it. He studies her in the way someone might scan a file, searching for information. When John looks at her, she thinks it's always with a kind of tender apology for who they are, for what they've become.
You really do look sad.
Oh, just a sucker for a happy ending. She forces a smile. I guess I just thought when you found something that it might show it all ended well. Don't take it personally, he says, touching her arm.
Oh, I couldn't care less, really, she says, brusquely. But it'd fit the feature much better if we could end on a high note. Melissa might not even want me to write the thing if it doesn't end well. She brushes a lock of hair from her face. You know what she's like. Let's keep it upbeat. Readers get enough misery from the news pages.
I feel like I rained on your birthday, he says, as they make their way across the pub.
He has to stoop and shout it into her ear. Don't worry about it, she shouts back. It's a pretty apt finish to the day I've had.
Come out with us, Rory says, stopping her with a hand on her elbow. We're going ice skating. Someone's pulled out, so we have a spare ticket.
Ice skating?
It's a laugh.
I'm 32 years old. I can't go ice skating.
It's his turn to look incredulous. Oh, well then. He nods understandingly. We can't have you toppling off your Zimmer frame.
I thought ice skating was for children, teenagers.
Then you're a very unimaginative person, Miss Howarth. Finish your drink and come with us. Have a bit of fun. Unless you really can't get out of what you planned.
She feels for her phone, tucked into her bag, tempted to turn it on again. But she doesn't want to read John's inevitable apology. Doesn't want the rest of this evening coloured by his absence, his words, the ache for him. If I break my leg, she says, you're contractually obliged to drive me in and out of work for 6 weeks.
It might be interesting, as I don't own a car. Will you settle for a piggyback?
He's not her type. He's sarcastic, a bit chippy, probably several years younger than she is. She suspects he earns significantly less than she does, and probably still shares a flat. It's possible he doesn't even drive. But it's the best offer she's likely to get at 6:45 on her 32nd birthday. And Ellie has decided that pragmatism is an underrated virtue. And if my fingers get sliced off by someone's random skate, you have to sit at my desk and type for me.
You only need one finger for that, or a nose. God, you hacks are a bunch of prima donnas, he says. Right, everyone, drink up. The ticket says we've got to be there for 8:30.
As Ellie walks back from the tube some time later, she realizes the pain in her side is not from the skating, although she hasn't fallen over so often since she was learning to walk, but because she has laughed pretty solidly for almost 2 hours. Skating was comic and exhilarating, and she had realized as she took her first successful baby steps onto the ice that she rarely experienced the pleasure of losing herself in simple physical activity. Rory had been good at it. Most of his friends were.
We come here every winter, he said,
gesturing at the temporary rink, floodlit and surrounded by office buildings.
They put it up in November and we probably come every fortnight. It's easier if you've had a few drinks first. You relax more. Come on, let your limbs go. Just lean forwards a bit.
He had skated backwards in front of her, his arms outstretched so that she clutched them. When she fell over, he laughed mercilessly. It was liberating to do this with someone whose opinion she cared so little for. If it had been John, she would have fretted that the chill of the ice was making her nose red. She would have been thinking the whole time about when he would have to leave. They have arrived at her door. Thanks, she says to Rory. Tonight was going pretty badly, and I ended up having a great time.
Least I could do, after raining all over your birthday with that letter.
I'll get over it.
Who'd have thought? Ellie Howarth has a heart.
It's just an ugly rumour.
You're not bad, you know, he says, a smile playing around his eyes, for an old bird.
She wants to ask him if he's talking about the skating, but she's suddenly unnerved by what he might say. And you're all charm.
You're...
He glances back down the road towards the tube station. She wonders, briefly, if she should invite him in. But even as she considers it, she knows it won't work. Her head, her flat, her life are full of John. There's no room for this man. Perhaps what she actually feels for him is sisterly, and only mildly confused by the fact that he is not exactly ugly. He's studying her face again, and she has the unnerving suspicion that her deliberation was written on her face.
I'd better go, he says, gesturing towards his friends.
Yes, she says. Thanks again, though.
No problem.
I'll see you at work.
He kisses her cheek, then turns and half jogs towards the station. She watches him go, feeling oddly bereft. Ellie makes her way up the stone steps and reaches for her key. She will reread the new letter and go through the papers, checking for clues. She'll be productive. She'll channel her energies. She feels a hand on her shoulder and jumps, stifling a scream.
John is on the step behind her, a bottle of champagne and a ridiculously large bunch of flowers under one arm. I'm not here, he says. I'm in Somerset giving a lecture to a writer's group who are talentless and include at least one interminable bore.
He stands there as she catches her breath.
You can say something, as long as it's not go away.
She's mute. He puts the flowers and champagne on the step and pulls her into his arms. His kiss has the warmth of his car.
I've been sitting over there for almost half an hour. I started to panic that you weren't coming home at all.
Everything inside her melts. She drops her bag, feels his skin, his weight, his size, and allows herself to fall against him. He takes her cold face in his warm hands.
Happy birthday, he says, when they finally pull apart.
Somerset, she says, a little giddy. Does that mean...
all night.
It's her 32nd birthday, and the man she loves is there with champagne and flowers, and is going to spend all night in her bed.
So, can I come in? He says.
She frowns at him in a way that says, do you really need to ask? Then she picks up the flowers, the champagne, and heads upstairs.
Tuesday, I'm busy. To tell the truth, I'm not all that crazy about us catching up anymore. I'm guessing that just being up front is going to be a wee bit less insulting than meeting up and then just not agreeing to do so again.
Male to female, via email. Chapter 18.
Ellie, can I have a word?
She's sliding her bag under her desk, her skin still moist from the shower she had not half an hour previously, her thoughts still elsewhere. Melissa's voice from the glass office is hard, a brutal re-entry into real life.
Of course.
She nods and smiles obligingly. Someone has left a coffee for her. It's lukewarm, has obviously been there some time. There is a note underneath it, addressed to Jane Torville, that reads,
Lunch?
She has no time to digest this. She has whipped off her coat, is walking into Melissa's office, noting with dismay that the features editor is still standing. She perches on a chair and waits as Melissa walks slowly round her desk and sits down. She's wearing a pair of velvety black jeans and a black polo neck, and has the toned arms and stomach of someone who does several hours of Pilates every day. She sports what the fashion pages would call statement jewellery, which Ellie assumes is just a trendy way of saying big. Melissa lets out a little sigh and stares at her. Her eyes are a startling violet, and Ellie wonders briefly whether she's wearing coloured contact lenses. They're the exact shade of her necklace.
This isn't a conversation I'm entirely comfortable having, Ellie, but it's become unavoidable.
Oh?
It's nearly a quarter to 11.
Ah, yes, I
appreciate that features is considered the more relaxed end of the nation, but I think we're generally agreed that a quarter to 10 is pretty much the absolute latest I want my staff at their desks.
Yes,
I like to give my writers a chance to prepare themselves for conference. That gives them time to read the day's newspapers, check the websites, talk, inspire, and be inspired.
She swivels a little in her seat. Checks an email.
It's a privilege to be in conference, Ellie. A chance a lot of other writers would be very glad to have. I'm finding it hard to see how you can possibly be prepared to a professional degree if you're skidding in here minutes beforehand.
Ellie's skin prickles.
With wet hair.
I'm very sorry, Melissa. I had to wait in for a plumber and...
Let's not, Ellie, she says quietly. I'd rather you didn't insult my intelligence.
and unless you're going to be able to convince me that you have a plumber in attendance almost every other day of the week, I'm afraid I have to conclude that you're not taking this job very seriously.
Eddie swallows.
Our web presence means there's no place to hide on this newspaper anymore. Every writer's performance can be judged not just by the quality of their work on our print pages, but by the number of hits their stories get online. Your performance, Ellie, she consults a piece of paper in front of her, has dropped by almost 40% in a year. Ellie can say nothing. Her throat dries. The other editors and writers are congregating outside Melissa's office, clutching oversized notepads and polystyrene cups. She watches them glance through the glass at her, some curious, some vaguely embarrassed, as if they know what is happening to her. She wonders, briefly, if her work has been a wider topic of conversation, and feels humiliated. Melissa is leaning across her desk. When I took you on, you were hungry. You were ahead of the game. It was why I picked you above any number of other regional reporters who, frankly, would have sold their grandmothers to be in your position. Melissa, I don't want to know what's going on in your life, Ellie. I don't want to know if you have personal problems, if someone close to you has died, if you're in mountains of debt. I don't even particularly want to know if you're seriously ill. I just want you to do the job you're paid to do. You must know by now that newspapers are unforgiving. If you don't pull in the stories, we don't get the advertising, or indeed the circulation figures. If we don't get those things, we're all out of a job. Some of us sooner than others. Am I making myself clear?
Very clear, Melissa.
Good. I don't think there's any point in you coming to conference today. Get yourself sorted out and I'll see you in the meeting tomorrow. How's that love letters feature coming along?
Good. Yes.
She's standing, trying to look as if she knows what she's doing. Right, you can show me tomorrow. Please tell the others to come in on your way out.
At a little after 12:30, she runs the four flights of stairs down to the library, her mood still dark, the joys of the previous evening forgotten. The library is like an empty warehouse. The shelves are now bare around the counter. The misspelt paper note is ripped off, only two sides of sellotape remaining. Behind the second set of swing doors, she can hear furniture being dragged. The chief librarian is running a finger down a list of figures, his glasses tilted at the end of his nose. Is Rory around?
He's busy.
Can you tell him I can't meet him for lunch?
I'm not sure where he is.
She feels anxious about Melissa noticing she's not at her desk. Well, are you likely to see him? I need to tell him that I've got to go out on this feature. Can you tell him I'll pop down at the end of the day?
Perhaps you should leave him a note.
But you said you didn't know where he was.
He looks up, his brow lowered.
Sorry, but we're in the final stages of our move. I don't have time to be passing on messages.
He sounds impatient. Fine. I'll just head up to personnel and waste their time asking for his mobile number, shall I? Just so I can make sure I don't stand him up and waste his time.
He holds up a hand.
I'll tell him if I see him.
Oh, don't trouble yourself. So sorry to have bothered you.
He turns slowly towards her and fixes her with what her mother might have termed an old-fashioned look.
We in the library may be considered something not far short of an irrelevance by you and your ilk, Miss Howarth. But at my age, I stop a little short of office dog's body. Forgive me if that inconveniences your social life.
She remembers, with a start, Rory's claim that the librarians can all put a face to a byline. She doesn't know this man's name. She blushes as he disappears through the swing doors. She's cross with herself for behaving like a stroppy teenager. Cross with the old man for being so uncooperative. Cross that Melissa's icy assessment means she can't have a cheerful lunch outside on a day that had started so well.
John had stayed till almost 9 o'clock. The train from Somerset didn't get in until 11:15, he said, so there was no point in racing off. She had cooked him scrambled eggs on toast, almost the only thing she can cook well, and sat there in bed, blissfully stealing bits from his plate as he ate it. They'd only spent a whole night together once before, back in the early days of their relationship, when he had claimed to be obsessed with her.
Last night, it had been like those early days. He had been tender, affectionate, as if his impending holiday had made him extra sensitive to her feelings. She didn't talk about it. If this past year has taught her one thing, it is to live in the present. She immersed herself in every moment, refusing to cloud it by considering the cost. The fall would come, it always did, but she usually collected enough memories to cushion it a little. She stands on the stairs, thinking of his bare, freckled arms wrapped around her, his sleeping face on her pillow. It had been perfect. Perfect. A small voice wonders whether one day, if only he'd think about it hard enough, he'll realize that their whole life could be like that. It's a short taxi ride to the post office in Langley Street. Before she leaves the office, she takes care to tell Melissa's secretary. "Here is my mobile number, if she wants me," she says, her voice dripping with professional courtesy. "I'll be about an hour." Although it's lunchtime, the post office isn't busy. She walks to the front of the non-existent queue and waits obediently for the electronic voice to call, "Till number four, please." "Can I talk to someone about P.O. boxes, please?" "Hang on." The woman disappears, then re-emerges, pointing for her to move to the end, where there is a door. "Margie will meet you down there." A young woman sticks her head around the door. She's wearing a name tag, a large gold chain with a crucifix, and a pair of heels so high that Ellie wonders how she can bear to stand in them, let alone spend a whole day working in them. She smiles, and Ellie thinks briefly how rare it is that anyone smiles at you in the city anymore. "This is going to sound a little strange," Ellie begins, "but is there a way of finding out who rented a P.O. box years ago?" "They can change pretty frequently. When are you talking about?" Ellie wonders how much to tell her, but Margie has a nice face, so she adopts her confidential tone. She reaches into her bag and pulls out the letters, carefully enclosed in a clear plastic folder. "It's a bit of a strange one. It's some love letters I found. They're addressed to a P.O. box here, and I want to return them." She has Margie's interest. It's probably a nice change from benefit payments and catalogue returns. "P.O. Box 13. Ellie points at the envelope. Margie's face reveals recognition. "13? You know the one?" "Oh, yes." Margie's lips are compressed, as if she's considering how much she's allowed to say. "That P.O. box has been held by the same person for, almost 40 years. Not that that's particularly unusual in itself." "So what is?" "The fact that it's never had a letter. Not one. We've contacted the holder lots of times to give her the chance to shut it down. She says she wants to keep it open. We say it's up to her if she wants to waste the money." She peers at the letter. "Love letter, is it? Oh, how sad. Can you give me her name?" Ellie's stomach tenses. This could be a better story even than she'd envisaged. The woman shakes her head. "Sorry, I can't. Data protection and all that." "Oh, please." She thinks of Melissa's face, if she can come back with a forbidden love that lasted 40 years. "Please, you have no idea how important this is to me. Sorry, I really am, but it's more than my job's worth." Ellie swears under her breath and glances behind her at the queue that has suddenly appeared. Margie is turning back to her door. "Thank you anyway," Ellie says, remembering her manners. "No problem." Behind them, a small child is crying, trying to escape from the restraints of its pram. "Hang on!" Ellie's rustling in her bag. "Yes?" She grins. "Could I, leave a letter in it?" "Dear Jennifer, please excuse the intrusion, but I have come across some personal correspondence that I believe may be yours, and I welcome the opportunity to return it to you. I can be contacted on the numbers below. Yours sincerely, Ellie Howarth." Rory looks at it. They're sitting at the pub across from the Nation. It's dark, even so early in the evening, and under the sodium lights, green removal lorries are still visible outside the front gate.
men in overalls travelling backwards and forwards up the wide steps to the entrance. They've been an almost permanent fixture for weeks now.
What? You think I've got the tone wrong?
No. He's sitting beside her on the banquette, one foot angled against the table leg in front of them.
What then? You're doing that thing with your face.
He grins. I don't know. Don't ask me. I'm not a journalist.
Come on. What does the face mean?
Well, doesn't it make you feel a bit...
What?
I don't know. It's so personal. And you're going to be asking her to air her dirty linen in public.
She might be glad of the chance. She might find him again.
There's a note of defiant optimism in her voice. Well, she might be married, and they've spent 40 years trying to get over her affair.
I doubt it. Anyway, how do you know it's dirty linen? They might be together now. It might have had a happy ending.
And she kept the P.O. box open for 40 years. It didn't have a happy ending.
He hands back the letter.
She might even be mentally ill.
Oh, so holding a torch for someone means you're mad, obviously.
Keeping a P.O. box open for 40 years without getting a single letter in it is on the far side of normal behaviour.
He has a point, she concedes. But the idea of Jennifer and her empty P.O. box has taken hold of her imagination. More importantly, it's the closest thing she has to a decent feature. I'll think about it, she says.
She doesn't tell him she posted the good copy that afternoon. So, he says, did you have a good time last night? Not too sore today?
What?
The ice skating.
Oh, a little.
She straightens her legs, feeling the tightness in her thighs, and reddens a little when she brushes his knee with her own. In-jokes have sprung up between them. She is Jane Torville. He is the humble librarian, there to do her bidding. He texts her, with deliberate misspellings. Please will the smart lady come and have a drink with the humble librarian later. I heard you came down to find me.
She glances at him, and he's grinning again. She grimaces. Your boss is so grumpy. Honestly, it was as if I'd asked him to sacrifice his firstborn, when all I was doing was trying to get a message to you.
He's all right, Rory says, wrinkling his nose. He's just stressed, really stressed. This is his last project before he retires, and he's got 40,000 documents to move in the right order, plus the ones that are being scanned for digital storage.
We're all busy, Rory.
He just wants to leave it shipshape. He's old school. You know, everything's for the good of the paper. I like him. He's of a dying breed.
She thinks of Melissa, she of the cold eyes and high heels, and cannot help but agree with him.
He knows everything there is to know about this place. You should talk to him sometime.
Yes, because he's obviously taken such a shine to me.
I'm sure he would if you asked him nicely.
Like I speak to you?
No, I said nicely.
Are you going to go for his job?
Me?
Rory lifts his glass to his lips.
Nah, I want to go travelling, South America. This was only meant to be a holiday job for me. Somehow I ended up staying 18 months.
You've been here 18 months?
You mean you hadn't noticed me?
He makes a mock hurt face, and she blushes again. I thought I would have seen you before now.
Ah, you hacks only see what you want to see. We're the invisible drones, there merely to fulfill your bidding.
He's smiling.